Welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
The answer to the age-old question of why bad things happen to good people is that those good people planned their lives that way. I know that's surprising, but it is true. You're going to see. This is amazing. Welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes. Our guest today is the wonderful Robert Schwartz. Rob is the world's leading expert in one of the most important areas of afterlife research, which is life planning. Each of our lifetimes is just a bad day in school, or maybe it's a rough day at the gym. That's it. Before we're born, we are eager to plan into our lives as many opportunities for spiritual growth as we can. And those may not look like a happy time to you and me, but they're exciting to those who are planning their lives. This is a very important area. I'm not expert in it, and so I'm going to be learning with the rest of you. Welcome, Rob. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you, Roberta. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I have read the first of your books, not the second, and I should just say briefly, they're available on Amazon, right?
That's correct. From any bookstore, libraries can order them in as well, and on my website, www.yoursoulsplan.com.
Okay, the first is called Your Soul's Plan, and that's the one I've read. The second is called Your Soul's Gift. It's more recent. But what we're going to try to do today is just give you an introduction to an area that most people have no clue about. But I've known about it really for all of my research period, because many of the people in the early part of the 20th century, when they were communicating through deep trance mediums, talked about life planning. They just didn't talk about it in much detail. And what Rob has done for us, which is so important, is to really go into it, interview a lot of people, and get a lot of understanding that he can share with us about how this actually happens. But tell me briefly now, how did you get into this, Rob?
Well, Roberta, for me, the path to writing Your Soul's Plan and then Your Soul's Gift, this all started back in Chicago in 2003. I was self-employed at that time as a marketing and communications consultant, basically doing different kinds of corporate writing. And I felt deeply unfulfilled by that work. You know, I used to tell people at the time, I had the feeling if I were to fall off the face of the earth, I didn't think any of my clients would even notice. Yeah, they would just plug somebody else right in and carry right along. But at the same time, I had the feeling that there was a higher calling or a higher purpose for my life. I didn't know what it was. I wasn't sure how to figure out what it was. I tried a number of different things, conventional sorts of things, which didn't really shed any light on the matter. And so in May of 2003, I did something that is now commonplace for me, but at that time it was a first. I had a session with a psychic medium, and that really changed my life. She introduced me to the concept of spirit guides. I'd never heard of that before.
Yes.
I talked to my guides through her. They said to me, you planned your life, including your biggest challenges, before you were born. And I said, well, why in the world did I do that? And
right.
an understandable response.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, you did this for purposes of spiritual growth. And I probably would not have believed any of this, except that without me telling them, they knew what my challenges had been. They knew everything about me.
Sure.
And so they went on to explain why I had wanted to have those difficult experiences. That, of course, gave them total credibility. And that turned out to be a life-changing 1 hour. So I left the corporate sector, spent the next 3 years writing Your Soul's Plan. Had no idea during that 3 years if anyone was going to be interested in reading what I wrote, but I had to do it. I just felt the compulsion to do it. And then it has since led to a completely new and much more fulfilling life for me.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure that it must have been totally world-changing from your perspective. I mean, I know that too, because I find working in this field and meeting the people who need this information and being able to share it with them is just the greatest gift anybody could have. And so I really identify with that, Rob. It's a wonderful thing. So you wrote this book, and the book is really an examination of some individual stories, but tell us about the book. Tell us how it came together. What it is that you do there for people who have no clue that in fact they planned all the awful things that happened to them.
Well, what happened is that after the session with the medium, and after I decided that I would try to write a book about why we ourselves plan before birth to have difficult experiences in life, my first thought was that there must be people out there somewhere who remember their pre-birth plan. I'll find them. And so I actually spent a period of months going to different bulletin boards on the internet, posting notices saying, author, writing a book about how we plan our lives before we're born. If you remember your pre-birth planning, please contact me. And I heard from many, many people, but none of them actually remembered their pre-birth planning. They were writing in with memories of lives in other planets, lives in non-physical
dimensions. Oh, my goodness.
Right. Yeah, very interesting stories, but not at all what I had actually asked for.
And right.
So at that point, I basically turned it over to the universe, and I said, you know, I prayed, and I said, God, if you would like me to write this book, I will, but I need a little help here. And wouldn't you know it, within a very short time of saying that prayer, I came into contact with four mediums and channels who in one way or another could access information about what someone planned before they were born. So they became my colleagues, my collaborators for both of the books. And what we do in the books is that I first interview someone about a common life challenge. And between the two books, we cover pretty much every common challenge you can think of. It's things like physical illness, accidents, the death of a loved one, alcoholism, drug addiction, financial challenges, abusive relationships, everything you can think of.
Yeah, homosexuality,
so I interview some,
too. I noticed that I got very engrossed in someone's story in your new book about that. It's only a few percentage of the population. I asked my granddaughter, who's 12, what percent do you think of people are gay? She said, I don't know, 40%. I said, I think it's more like 3. But it's in the news so much that the young people think it must be many. But that's a particular challenge, which I think many who have it would say, I could not have planned this. And yet you're saying they all did, right?
That is my understanding, and I thought it was very important to have a chapter on the pre-birth planning of sexuality, because my understanding is, regardless of whether you're heterosexual or homosexual, you have chosen your sexuality before birth,
yes.
Or including bisexuality as well.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So what we did to research people's plans is that I would interview someone about a particular challenge or experience. Then that person would have 1, 2, or sometimes 3 sessions with the mediums and channels in which we would ask Spirit, did this person plan this experience before he or she was born? And if so, why? And then in the books, I present all of the information that comes through. So the intentions of the work are to help people awaken, by which I mean come into some awareness that they are an eternal soul, heal from the challenging experiences they've had, and see the deeper spiritual meaning and purpose of those challenges, which is, in fact, a large part of the healing.
All right. People listening are thinking there's no way, and I know this because whenever I tell people they planned these bad things, there's no way I would have planned that. But do people ever say that to you when with someone who's lost a child or they have a horrible illness or something none of us could imagine would be voluntary? Do people ever protest to you, I wouldn't have planned this, and what do you say to them?
There are people who say that, of course. It's actually a much smaller number of people than you might imagine, and I think the reason for that is that the people who come to the talks, who read the books, or who contact me by email, they're a self-selected group, and they tend, by and large, to be either believers in the concept of pre-birth planning, or they are at least open to the possibility. But there are some people who say, there's just no way I would ever have planned this. And, you know, my feeling is that every person's pre-birth plan is based on great wisdom and unconditional love. So if someone has planned to be someone who is not going to believe in this concept, I have total respect for that life path. I have no desire to pull anyone off their pre-planned path. And so whenever I get that reaction, I'm quiet. I'm just respectful of it.
Wow, you're a better man than I am. Because what I usually try to do is to help people understand by asking them to look at the things that they've learned or that they are learning from all of this. I mean, even, God forbid, the loss of a child or a really horrible illness, people who are at all self-introspective are able to sort of see, well, I learned this or that, but I wouldn't have chosen this as a way to learn that. But yes, I did. But you say that it's better to just respect when someone says, you're crazy, I never planned this. It's better to respect that and say, you know, as you will.
That's my own personal feeling on the matter. I believe that everyone is right where they need to be for their highest and greatest good. So it's not my place to pull somebody away from where they are. My role, I think, is simply to serve as a resource. So if someone comes to me and says, I hear that you have this idea that we planned our lives before birth, why would I have planned this or that? If they ask, then I'm happy to be there for them as a resource as best I can. But it is not my place to push this on anybody.
To I guess, probe a little farther, when someone just comes across you, doesn't come to you for help, but just you and they are talking on the plane and they say they lost their spouse and they'll never forgive the universe or God or whatever, and they're just so distressed and you give them this information and they hotly reject it, you don't think it's helpful to them because they're stuck with you on the plane. You don't think it's helpful to say, well, here are some of the things you can learn from this, or remember you're going to see him again soon, or anything like that. You don't think you need to try to open them? And I'm asking because I'm curious. I mean, you and I are in the same position of having knowledge many people don't have, and I just don't know whether I have a responsibility to share it.
I always take my cue from the other person. I follow their lead. So if they show interest or curiosity or ask a question, I try to meet them where they're at and respond to it appropriately. But I'm very, very respectful, and I just very much want to give everyone their space and whatever experience it is in life that they are choosing in that moment to have.
Well, I think it's easy for listeners to realize why you're the one chosen for the work that you're doing. And I was chosen to be the one who stands on a pulpit and just shouts to the universe, but doesn't so much counsel people. Good for you. I think that's wonderful that you have that kind of forbearance and strength. Okay, well, let's talk about two other kinds of things that are in the back of my mind that I'm just curious about. One of them is, suppose someone is, you know, someone who just has rejected, because we don't remember consciously, virtually never. Oh, that's another question we could ask at some point, whether anyone ever does remember the planning process consciously. But assuming they don't, someone has lost perhaps a child and a spouse in a fire or something, and someone set the fire, and they just can't get past it. This is a very tough lesson they planned, and they're not going to get an A in it. When they then graduate and discover, of course, that this was just like a bad day in school, nothing more, do they then feel compelled to plan an even harder version of the same lesson? Or do you have any information about what happens then in the planning for another lifetime?
My understanding is that it's highly individualized depending upon how the person feels about the life that's just been completed when they see it in the life review, which we all have. So the scenario that you just described, you can envision easily a wide range of reactions.
Oh, sure.
And some people would say, you know what, I learned what I had hoped to learn, or most of what I had hoped to learn from that experience, and I'm complete with it now. Then you could have people at the other end who look at how they responded to the child's death, and they might very well say, you know, I was consumed with rage for the rest of my life, and I wish that I could have responded in a quote-unquote higher way. Let me go back, do something similar again, and my hope is that I will be more forgiving, more understanding, more compassionate the next time around.
Yeah, I think that's a very good answer. I don't know myself, but the sense I get is it would be very individual because each lesson is individual. We're all at different stages of our spiritual development, and trying to fill in the gaps is a big reason why we need to plan our lives so that we're sure that we'll make the most use of this time. Do people ever remember the planning? Do you find people who do?
There are a small number of people who remember snippets of it. I can't off the top of my head think of anyone who has detailed recall of it, but there are people who remember little bits and pieces. I'll just share an anecdote with you. I talked with an 11-year-old girl in New Jersey who remembers choosing her mother, and what she described to me was that she was in a room with a lot of different souls who could be her mother.
Really?
And, yes, and she said, who would like to be my mother in this upcoming lifetime? And apparently they were arranged, at least from her vantage point, in different rows at different levels. So all of them raised their hand when she asked, who wants to be my mother, except for one who apparently was in the back row. And this soul sort of bent over, so to speak, so that the girl couldn't see her quite as well.
Oh my goodness.
And so when that happened, the girl said, I want you to be my mother. And so she chose the one that was trying to hide.
That's funny. That's interesting. Now, that would have been before any of them were born, or was this something that happened in a period of time when perhaps it was during the night on Earth and these people were meeting we're traveling out of body. How did that relate to the time of birth of the child? Do you know?
I believe that it can be done either way.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about that changing of our lives, life plans then. We come in with these marks we really want to hit and things we want to learn from those events. And we do really well with them, let's say. And my understanding, and tell me what your understanding is, but my understanding is we travel out of body every night or many nights, meet with our guides, and often maybe meet with those who helped us with the plan, maybe those who are close to us in this life and their guides, and maybe tweak the plan. Does that happen in your experience? Have you seen that?
That is very much my understanding. And the astral meetings during the sleep state are not just with the guides, but, you know, with family members,
right,
friends, co-workers, basically anybody that we're interacting with during the day. And, you know, the broader question there, I think, is how does pre-birth planning intersect with the free will decisions that we make during the day?
Great. So, I asked that question. Pretend I asked that question.
Okay.
Rob, how does all this interact with free will? That's a wonderful question.
Well, I have a hypothetical. It will take me a couple minutes to go through this, but
okay.
I can answer it that way. In Your Soul's Gift, I share the following hypothetical story. Let's say that there is a soul. And the soul is androgynous, but I'm going to use masculine and feminine pronouns here.
Sure.
Let's say that there is a soul that's planning an incarnation as a female. So we'll call this soul Sally.
Okay.
And Sally has had a multiple incarnation history of making certain plans before she comes into body. But then when she gets here, she has this tendency to defer to the wishes of others, to let others tell her how to lead her life, which is not an uncommon thing to do.
Of course.
So when Sally has her life reviews, she sees that she has this tendency, and she plans for the upcoming lifetime to heal it. So her hope is that she'll carry energetically into body the tendency to defer to the wishes of others. But the hope pre-birth is not that she will express it, but rather that she will heal it and come into her power, so to speak. So she sets up that plan. Now, let's say that there's another soul in her soul group who's planning an incarnation as a male. We'll call him George.
Okay.
Because they're in the same soul group, Sally knows about George and his plans. And let's say that George has had a multiple incarnation history of doing the opposite of Sally. When he gets into body, he tends to run roughshod over others, tell them what to do. He uses power inappropriately over others.
Right.
So he sees this in his life reviews, and he resolves to carry it back into body energetically. Again, not for the purpose of expressing it, but with the hope of healing it. So Sally knows that George has this plan, and she goes to him before either one of them is born, and she says, basically, hey, George, I am carrying into body the tendency to defer to the wishes of others with the intention of healing it and coming into my strength and power. I see that you are going to carry energetically into body the opposite tendency to exercise power inappropriately over others, also with the desire to heal it. What if you and I agree to marry, let's say around the age of 30, and although we know that this is likely to be a turbulent marriage, our hope is that I will learn to stand up for myself and you will learn to respect the wishes of others. Well. And George says, this is a great idea. Let's make that plan. So the plan is in place. Now, let's say that when Sally is here in body, say at the age of 25, she gets a job with an employer who is running roughshod over her, who is treating her with a profound lack of respect and kindness, telling her what to do. And let's say that Sally marshals her internal resources and she takes a stand. She says to the employer, stop. You may not treat me that way. If you want me to continue working here, you must treat me with respect and kindness. In the moment that Sally takes a stand like that, there's a tremendous increase in her vibration. If she can sustain the heightened vibration until she's 30, now one of two things will happen. Either she and George will never meet because by virtue of the law of attraction, their vibrations are too dissimilar, they never come together. Or if they do meet, again, because their vibrations are so different, there's no attraction between them. Now they have one date and then nothing comes from it. This is a hypothetical that shows you the intersection between pre-birth planning and free will.
Sure.
Sally used her free will to learn the plan lesson, which in turn obviated the need for the plan challenge, the difficult marriage, and so it simply never takes place. Now, people listening to this interview are then going to say, well, what about George? How does he learn
poor
what he
George.
Plans? Yeah,
yes.
Poor George. Well, the answer is that now a quote-unquote backup plan will be activated, which could be another relationship like the one planned with Sally, or it could be some sort of other completely different life experience that motivates and challenges him to respect the sovereignty of others. But there will be multiple opportunities for George to learn what he wanted to learn, because that's how the planning works.
Yes, that's a great example of how we're, my understanding anyway is, and you know much more than I about this, but my understanding is that we're constantly sort of tweaking and revising, maybe not needing something, maybe deciding as we get into a lifetime that we need a lesson we didn't realize we did need, and adding that in during in nighttime planning. I think that's a great example. Let's talk about that nighttime planning, though, because people are wondering about that. When our bodies sleep, we leave our bodies. So we're all astral travelers. Tell us about that. Tell us that process.
This is actually a little bit beyond my area of expertise. I'll just share what I know.
Okay.
Some of the astral travel is what you've described already. It's meeting with guides and the significant people in our lives to basically talk about how is it going? Are we playing for each other the roles that we would like to play for each other? And if not, what kind of modifications do we need to make? So that's one area of astral travel. Now, there's a whole other area, as I understand it, whereby you astral travel to places where you can be of service. And this can be other physical planets, non-physical planes, or very often it's actually this Earth in this dimension. So, for example, let's say that there's a natural disaster on the other side of the world, and a lot of people are in camps, and they're facing a health crisis. There's not enough food. You might astral travel to one or more of those people as you sleep, simply to sit next to them and whisper encouragement into their ears.
Huh. Well, that's something I had not thought about. So you've seen evidence that that's the case as well, that we
that's
were
right.
doing these interesting things. What a wonderful thing. And, of course, even though we don't consciously remember that experience, it is an experience we have had, just as our bodily experiences are experiences we've had. So it will affect us for good or ill, what we do outside of our bodies. So in the planning, though, I mean, this is what I sort of think of, Rob. I imagine us, you know, let's say we're part of each other's lives, you and me and our spirit guides and the other people in our lives and their spirit guides, we're all around this great big table under the trees with all the plans spread out and we're tweaking them. Is that how it happens? Or what do they, what, how formal are these meetings? And are there more sort of advanced guides there to advise us? And do you have any sense of how many, how often this might happen in a person's life typically?
You're talking about during the astral travel?
Yes.
You know, again, it really is beyond my area of expertise. I have focused really on the pre-birth planning and not so much on the modifications through the astral travel experience. So I actually don't know the answers to those questions.
Well, I'm not sure that anyone does, because you aren't the first person I've asked about this. But it does fascinate me, and I have a feeling it's something maybe that the Newton folks would know, because they've been very involved in lives between lives. And so we'll have to ask them that in another day. I just want to pause briefly and say, this is Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. My nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, and The Fun of Staying in Touch, which is about how we communicate with our loved ones, how they communicate with us. Our guest today is Robert Schwartz, and he will be a featured presenter at the Life in the Afterlife Conference being held September 25th to 27th, 2015 in Scottsdale, Arizona. Go to ASCSI.org to learn more. One of the things that we're doing there is called Life in the Afterlife for a reason. We have the leading experts from all over the world in the areas that are most important for us, who are trying to develop an in-depth understanding of what actually is going on from the perspective of death and the afterlife. This is just going to be a life-changing conference. I'm very excited, and I'm excited to meet you in person, Rob. We have a lot to talk about there.
Thank
as well.
Thank you. I look forward to meeting you as well.
So let's go back to talking about these tragedies, and everyone persists in thinking of them as tragedies. Young children who die, a family loses a child or two, and they're devastated. And anyone who, like that who's listening now is saying, you have to be crazy. You think I planned it, and I haven't learned a blessed thing from it. How does that help people to have that kind of experience? Do you have any insight there?
Well, I think the first level on which it helps is, if you do come to some awareness or some knowing that you planned the experience, whatever it may be, then that in alone in itself is powerfully healing and comforting, because then it goes from being a random, arbitrary, meaningless,
right,
purposeless experience to something that is imbued with deep purpose and deep meaning.
Yes.
That alone makes a huge difference. Then you can take it a level deeper, and if you do some work, and we can talk later about how one does this, but there are different ways that one can find out what one planned before one was born. And if you find out specifically why you planned a particular experience, then you can go about learning the lessons in a much more conscious manner. Not only that, it has the effect of pulling you out of victim consciousness. Victim consciousness, as I understand it, is basically the lowest vibratory state that a human being can be in. And it tends to be self-perpetuating, because once you're vibrating at the frequency of victim, you magnetize to yourself other experiences that seem to confirm to you that you are, in fact, a victim. So the way to get out of that is to raise your vibration, and you do that by understanding that you are the powerful creator of your life, that you planned it before you were born, and then taking it a level deeper and coming into some knowing of why you created this specific plan that you created.
Wow, that is a very powerful statement. I'm going to ask you to say it again, because people listening in the beginning didn't understand where it was going. So you're vibrating at, you think you're a victim. I can't restate it. Would you please restate it again so people will really internalize how important that is?
What I'm saying is that I think we live in a historical time period in which the average person, when something quote-unquote bad happens to them,
right,
they tend to feel or believe that they are a victim, either of another person or the universe or God or all of the above. And when you feel or believe that you are a victim, you vibrate at the frequency of victim, which, again, as I understand it, is the single lowest vibratory right. state a person can
right.
be in.
Right.
Once you're there, it tends to be self-perpetuating because you will, through the law of attraction, magnetize to yourself other experiences which seem to confirm to you that you are, in fact, a victim. So you don't want to spend any more time in that vibration than you have to.
Absolutely not.
There are a lot of different ways to get out of it, but one of the most powerful that I know of is simply to come into an awareness of the fact that you are the eternal, powerful, and courageous soul who planned your life and your challenges before you were born.
Okay, it's very hard to go from the depth of despair of having lost a child to understanding. I should just add one more thing, and then I want to go to talk about how we address this on a personal level. But another thing that, in my experience, causes people to plan these kinds of really devastating experiences is that, two things. Number one, I've had people say after their deaths that, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said this, she said, it turned out that having a very serious illness at the end of my life was perhaps the most important experience of my life because I needed to learn. I needed to learn to be dependent. I needed to learn weakness. She's a very powerful person. She needed to get that balance into her life. So that can be a reason we plan terrible things. Another reason we may plan terrible things is that one of the greatest reasons we're here is learning forgiveness. It can be very hard to forgive some things people do. So if we plan a devastating thing that takes all our attention, the whole goal there really can be to learn to forgive the fellow who drove the other car or the murderer or whoever. And that's sometimes, especially for more advanced beings, I think one of the main reasons we plan these what seem to be tragic or terrible experiences. But as you say, just the core understanding is that you're a powerful eternal being. You never begin, you never will end, and you planned everything. Just that is powerfully liberating when it comes to the risk of thinking you're just a little cog in this, a speck of sand in the sea that's the universe. You're not that at all.
Well, that's exactly right. I wouldn't argue with a word that you've just said, and your understanding is very similar to mine.
That's part of the fun of doing this work, don't you find? When you meet other people who have come from very different directions and done similar research, we complete each other's sentences.
That's right.
Always the case. There is really only one set of truths. And part of the fun for us is that because the serious scientists are still ignoring the truth, we get to do this work. Whereas if it were not this way, and I comfort myself, yeah, the world doesn't know these things yet, but at least you and I have the fun of doing this, which is something I wouldn't have missed for the world. So, all right, let's talk about how someone listening is resonating and saying, you know, I really have to get out of this rut that I'm in because I'm grieving or I can't get over this or that. How do they develop a better understanding of what their plan is?
Well, there are a number of ways to do this, Roberta. The most powerful way that I know of is something called a between lives soul regression. This is a form of hypnosis. I do this all the time with my clients. Very safe, very natural. It's usually about a 3.5-hour session. It's similar to a past life regression in that the client goes into a past life briefly, but whereas a past life regression would end at the end of the past lifetime, in a between lives soul regression, it keeps going. The client's consciousness leaves the body at the end of the past life, transitions back to the other side, and then at that point, a lot of different things can happen. But what I see in my practice is that about 80% of clients are greeted by one of their spirit guides, They will then talk briefly with the guide as to why they were shown that particular past life and how it impacted the plan for the current lifetime.
And then, fascinating.
Yes. It gets even better, though, because then once that discussion is over, the guide usually escorts the person they can go to a number of different places, but usually they go to a meeting with what is called the Council of Elders. The council consists of the very wise, highly evolved, and loving beings who oversee the cycle of reincarnation on Earth. They know everything about everyone who's here, not just the plan for the current life, but every past life they've ever had. So if you meet with the council, this is a potentially transformative, life-changing experience.
Wow.
I have clients who come out of the council meeting and they say, you know what, they answered every question I have and I don't have any questions anymore. So it's deeply illuminating and healing.
Wow.
And there's a lot of information about this on my website at yoursoulsplan.com. So that's one thing that people could do. Now, the other ways to get information about your life plan, you can work with an astrologer. Any good astrologer should be able to tell you at least something about your pre-birth plan. Numerology is very powerful. You can either work with a numerologist or just get a basic book on numerology, do the basic calculations yourself. They're quite easy to do. I've done that, and I was impressed with the specificity and the accuracy of the information that came through. Another thing one can do is simply to meditate on it. And this is a good way to get an answer to any question. Just pose the question at the beginning of your meditation, allow your mind to go blank, and then see what comes to you. You may get an answer in the meditation. It's more likely that a seed will be planted by your guides that germinates some weeks or months down the road. So people should be aware of that. There's a particular technique that can be used to get information about a pre-birth plan, or again, an answer to any question, and that is, before you go to bed at night, speak out loud to your soul and ask one question. So it could be, what is my plan for this lifetime? And then ask your soul to send you a dream that contains an answer to the question. Also ask, and this is very important, to be awakened when the dream ends. Otherwise, you won't remember it in the morning. Then keep pen and paper or a digital recorder next to the bed. This technique really works. I've used it myself. It may not work the first time or maybe even the fifth or tenth time someone tries it, but if you can stick with it without getting frustrated, it will eventually work. Now, if you get frustrated, it's better to put it aside for a couple of weeks and come back to it, because the frustration can block it from working.
It's just a variation on that. Because I am determined not to be psychic, my guides have learned that the only way that I will be willing to work with them is if I ask a question and then go to sleep, they'll leave it in my mind for the morning. And they're very, isn't it wonderful how our guides will accept our idiosyncrasies and work with us? Mm. They never say, to heck with you, lady. That's never been said. Instead, they do what I ask them to do. So that's another thing you can do if you find it too complicated to try to be awakened and all of that. If you just will say, please help me understand X, or help me know about Y. And it's a simple thing. They'll leave an answer in your mind, and then just pay attention to the first thing that's in your mind in the morning.
That's very similar, and that would be another way to do it, to ask your guides and just do it just like that.
So let's talk about the really dramatic past life regression into the period between lives, which takes 3 hours plus. This has to be done where you are, right? This is not a long distance thing like a reading with a medium.
No, actually, on the contrary, at this time, I'm offering it only by phone or Skype.
Really?
I used to do it both in person and long distance. And what I discovered over a period of time was that it always seems to work just as well for any given individual over the phone or by Skype as it does in person. And for a large percentage of people, it's actually better to do it by phone or Skype. The reason being that the whole key to going into trance is to relax. And many people understandably, are more relaxed in the comfort and privacy and familiarity of their own home, rather than coming to an office they've never been to and having someone they've never met sit next to them and basically stare at them the whole time that they're having the regression. So it really works just beautifully by phone and Skype.
Isn't that fascinating? The same is true with mediums, obviously. Doesn't matter where the medium is. And even if someone is in the United States and the medium is in Australia or China or whatever, wherever, as long as you can get the time right, the reading is absolutely as effective. But knowing that you can do it this way, even when, you know, when you're doing hypnosis, is fascinating to me.
Yeah, it really works quite well. And again, because it works so well by phone and Skype, I've actually stopped, at least for the time being, doing it in person. I do miss working with clients in person, though, so I imagine at some point I'll start to do that again.
Well, that's exciting. Is there a percentage of people who can't do this? They're too fearful or they're too resistant?
You know, that's a good question, and there seems to be debate within the hypnosis community as to whether or not literally everyone can do it if only they will try enough times and learn to relax deeply
right.
enough, versus another school of thought, which I've heard a number of hypnosis professionals say that there is a certain percentage, whatever it may be, of people who can't be hypnotized. I truly don't know what the answer to that question is, but there is research to show that going into trance is a skill that people become more proficient at with practice. And specifically, the research shows that people become most proficient between the fifth and tenth attempt. The difficulty there, of course, is that if somebody doesn't go into trance on the first or second try, they generally get discouraged and don't go on to try five or ten times. What I can say is that the vast majority of people do go into trance on the first or second attempt, but every hypnosis professional will tell you they have some clients who don't go into trance.
That is fascinating. Well, I may do this with you, Rob. I would be very interested in trying it because this is something I have never done. Is this like what they do with with Wayne Newton's I'm blocking his first name.
But Michael
Newton, that's right. What Michael Newton's folks do, is this similar to what they do doing between life's regressions?
It is. It's essentially the same kind of work, yes.
That's another talk for another day. I should just mention to folks, Michael Newton wrote Journey of Souls, Destiny of Souls, and I think one third one, which I cannot recall the name of it now, but his books are fascinating explorations of, as far as I can determine, of what the between life period looks like to your oversoul, as opposed to the person who just died. It's a fascinating system, but it looks remarkably different from the process that's reported when we speak to someone who has just died directly through a medium. They seem to be much more in an illusion that our larger mind does not need, because of course being there is its natural home. Well, that's all very helpful. Is there anything to be fearful about? People who are thinking about trying to get past some terrible life-changing event, and maybe they don't want to or can't be regressed, or they don't have the time, or they can't afford to get help. What else can they do if they just all of this? I mean, how do we? Is prayer helpful? Are there other things you found that people have done that have enabled them to integrate these experiences?
You know, there are many, many different sorts of healing modalities. I think for anybody, even if they're not facing a particular challenge, prayer and meditation are probably the two most important things you can do. Prayer and regular meditation will get you about 80% of where you want to go, and then the other 20% is very individualized, whatever sort of modality most resonates with you. But I encourage everybody to pray on a regular basis. I don't think we quite understand, and perhaps the human mind even can't completely understand exactly how prayer works or what it does, but it clearly is tremendously, tremendously powerful. Something else that someone can do, I do offer 1 hour spiritual guidance sessions. That's conversation. It's not hypnosis. Drawing upon the research I've done into people's pre-birth plans. And there's a specific exercise we often do in a spiritual guidance session called the Divine Virtues Exercise, which what I found in my research is that very often the pre-birth planning of a life challenge is based, at least in part, on the soul's desire to cultivate and then express while in body certain qualities that are important to the soul. And I gave these qualities the name Divine Virtues. Over a period of time, I noticed that some came up in people's pre-birth planning sessions much more than others. I made a list of those. There's now about 27 or 28 of them. And so in this Divine Virtues exercise that I developed, we work with this list, and there's a method I have to take people through it so that by the time they're done, they have a reasonably good sense of the, it's usually two or three virtues that they incarnated to deepen in.
Wow.
And once you know which two or three you're working on, it fills your life with much greater meaning, and then you can focus consciously on cultivating those virtues.
Yeah, what a wonderful idea that is, and they can learn about that on your website too, your Soul's Plan.
Yes, yoursoulsplan.com. Go to the online store, the spiritual guidance section, and then that information would be under spiritual guidance sessions.
Now, people are listening to us who may say, well, I don't care that many people may have planned their lives. I know what happened to me was a pure accident. Are there any pure accidents in your estimation now?
Well, it depends on your definition of accident. My understanding, there are things that happen that are not planned prior to birth, and that's necessarily so because we all have free will. So, of course, a lot of things are going to happen that are not planned before birth. But my understanding is that something can't come into your experience unless your vibration, your frequency, allows it to come into your experience. So from that perspective, which is a higher dimensional perspective, it could be argued that there actually are no accidents. And then when you talk about whether something was planned or not planned, it isn't a black and white issue like that. Generally, and there are exceptions to this, but generally, life challenges are planned with varying degrees of possibility or probability. So some things are fixed in place. For example, if you choose to be born with a birth defect and to incarnate in an historical time period in which medical science can't treat the birth defect, then you're going to have that physical disability. That's pretty much set in stone. But most life challenges are not planned that way. They are possibilities or probabilities. And whether or not they actually occur depend very much on the free will decisions we make. Like the hypothetical example I gave before, if you make free will decisions that allow you to learn the planned lessons, then very often the planned challenges never occur.
All of this is fascinating. I wish we had more time to talk, but we're coming to the end of our time. My guest today has, of course, been Robert Schwartz. He is one of the people who has made a small but essential part of the afterlife study. He's done a stellar job of really getting deep into it. And so if this is an area where you think you're having trouble, you've had a problem in your life, I really recommend that you talk to him and see if he can help you to integrate a tragedy or a disaster into your whole life. Again, it's yoursoulsplan.com, and we'll be talking to him again. This is exciting. I'm so glad you're here. But meanwhile, this has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. You are a powerful, eternal being. You never began, you never will end. And when you fully grasp everything that means, it's going to change everything in your life. If you'd like to learn more of the amazing things we're learning about how our one reality actually works, past episodes of Seek Reality are available for free on iTunes. Just search there for Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. And, of course, my own nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, and The Fun of Staying in Touch, which is about the ways our loved ones are communicating with us, and we can return the favor and try to communicate with them. You'll find details about all my books, plus my blog at robertagrimes.com. Next week, we're going to be hearing all the way from the Netherlands, from Ineke Kodum. Ineke's wonderful book, In the Light of Death, explores a very important area about which much too little is known, which is all the extraordinary spiritual experiences that surround the time of death. Some of this is going to blow your mind. Please join us next week. What Bob Schwartz is doing, as I say, is so important because our whole purpose in being here is to learn and grow spiritually. There doesn't seem to be any other reason that the universe exists. And so what he's doing is helping us to understand how that process works. And until he began to do this work, I don't think anyone else really had. So we all owe you, Bob, a debt of gratitude for doing that. If
Thank
you're
you.
Finding this to be shocking, if you're hearing it for the first time and you're going, whoa, please understand, this is not bad news. This is extraordinary and wonderful news. Life is not random. Life is planned. Life is perfect. And underneath it all is everlasting love. We are so protected at all times. However, we choose some pretty bad things sometimes to happen in our lives. Since you chose your life, since you chose some terrible things, isn't it time now for you to learn how to wring all the spiritual growth you can from each of those things we used to think were only tragedies and pain? I think you'll find it's going to make all the difference if you begin to do that. But meanwhile, though, please enjoy and make the most of this coming week in our one reality, knowing that you are a powerful, eternal being and you are infinitely loved.